Joe Biden is what so many others pretend to be, a statesman with sound judgment who doesn't have to hide behind bluster to keep America strong. So Joe Biden won't just make a good vice president, he will make a great vice president.
So will Barack Obama's pick of Joe Biden to be his vice presidential running mate help him win the presidency in November? Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Monday, August the 25th. And we will talk politics this hour with our guest, who is the publisher of Harper's Magazine and also the author of the new book, You Can't Be President: The Outrageous Barriers to Democracy in America. In the book, John MacArthur points out that during this year, it seemed like the realization of democracy with a presidential race featuring a woman, an African American, and the oldest candidate ever. But he says a close look at the three presidential candidates then, the two now, shows they're cast mainly from the same political mold. Do you agree with that or not? And do you agree with his claim that, despite what you learned in school, you can't be president? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. John R. MacArthur is president and publisher of Harper's Magazine. He has written for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post, and he is the author of You Can't Be President: The Outrageous Barriers to Democracy in America. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks a lot for being with us.
Now, delighted to be here.
I do want to talk about the content of your book for sure, but I wanted to also talk about some of the current news from the campaign trail. What do you make of Barack Obama's selection of Joe Biden as his running mate that we learned over the weekend?
Well, it's an utterly conventional pick. I mean, it's a guy who follows orders. I mean, he's a reliable member of the Democratic Party caucus. He's followed the lead of all the leadership. He's never become one of the important leaders in the caucus. I mean, he's had some important judiciary. He was chairman of the Judiciary Committee, and he was chairman of He's chairman of Foreign Relations, but he's never done anything unconventional in his life, which is what Obama wanted. He wanted a white man. He needed a white man, and he needed somebody he could count on, I think, to keep his mouth shut. Now, already the stuff is coming out. It's in my book also. It just so happens I wrote a whole chapter about the bankruptcy bill, so-called Bankruptcy Reform Act, where Biden supported it. I always call it the Bankruptcy Act, where it made it much harder for people to file for bankruptcy. Biden supported that and took a lot of money from MBNA, the big credit card company in his home state of Delaware. And then his son, of course, is now being targeted in the press because he went to work for MBNA. This could be a real problem for Obama. I'm a little surprised they didn't vet this a little bit more carefully. But with Biden, he was trying to do something utterly mainstream, utterly conventional that wouldn't get him into trouble. And he couldn't pick Hillary Clinton. That's like inviting your enemy into the tent. He couldn't pick Evan Bayh because he's a Clintonite. That would have also been a kind of a Trojan horse. And when we get into talking about a little bit more about the campaign later on, I'll talk more about how I'm certain that the Clintons have not conceded, that Hillary Clinton is still in effect running for president.
I'd like to talk about that now. Do you think putting her name in nomination at the Democratic convention this week is step one there?
Yeah, I think it's foolish for Obama to let her, Hillary and Bill, have so much airtime, primetime airtime. You know, look back to the end of the primaries. Hillary Clinton was on the upswing. She was waxing. He was waning. People didn't pay any attention to the results in the South Dakota primary, where she won handily. she thinks she should be president. She thinks she should have won. And she's hoping very much that he loses to McCain. McCain will be a one-termer, and that she will get a chance to run again in 2012. So I don't understand. Dick Morris is the only other person besides me, as far as I know, who's saying this, the disgraced former Clinton advisor who is still very smart about politics. And he wrote in his blog the other day that if Obama can't stand up to the Clintons, how can he stand up to President Putin of Russia? Which I thought was a fairly amusing line.
Yeah, well, did he not, though, stand up in a way by not selecting her as the vice presidential running mate?
Well, that would have been suicidal. I mean, I don't think Barack Obama is suicidal, but he is an appeaser, and he's trying to appease the Clintons, and you cannot appease the Clintons. The Clintons will never be happy unless they're back in power. There is no second best. There's no second choice. There's nothing, no other job that she wants. She wants to be president. And so I think it's a tactical, grave tactical error on his part and his campaign's part to give them so much free airtime.
Well, Clinton's supporters are balking still about supporting Obama. Doesn't he have to do that?
No. I mean, he could say, look, we're going to, she can speak at 6 p.m., not at 9 or whenever she's going to speak. She can, there are other times for her to speak, and there are other ways for the Clinton delegates to express themselves in other ways. But I think this is if you want to beat the Clintons, you have to beat them completely because they just don't give up.
Yeah. Well,
if he wants to take away power from them, he's got to take it away. Otherwise, he's fighting a two-front war. He's fighting the McCain campaign, and he's fighting the Clintons at the same time.
Yeah. Well, you don't seem very impressed with Joe Biden calling it a mainstream pick. Joe Biden is there in part because of his foreign policy credentials, but the Obama campaign also hopes that he will appeal to the working class and the middle class. You're saying Joe Biden is no friend of the working class or the middle class?
My goodness, if he were a friend of the working class, he never would have voted for this terrible bankruptcy bill, which really puts the squeeze on people who are maxed out on their credit cards. Makes it very hard for them to file for bankruptcy. Charges them, I think there's now a fee of $600 or something, which people just don't have to file for the old-fashioned bankruptcy where you could spread the payments out and actually stop paying at some point. This is all about squeezing the last nickels and dimes out of bankrupts. And these are the same people who are losing their homes right now because of the mortgage crisis. That's something Joe Biden voted for because he gets a tremendous amount of money from the credit card industry in Delaware. The other thing about Biden is he's a reliable supporter of free trade agreements, so-called free trade agreements like NAFTA and permanent normal trade relations with China. Which are in the process, if they haven't already completed the job, of wiping out industrial employment in this country. So for Obama to say that this guy is a friend of the working man or the working woman is a stretch.
Yeah, well, here's Joe Biden talking about why he thinks John McCain is out of touch with the working man and woman.
Ladies and gentlemen, your kitchen table's like mine. You sit there at night after you put the kids to bed, and you talk. And you talk about what you need. You talk about how much you're worried about being able to pay the bills. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's not a worry John McCain has to worry about. It's a pretty hard experience. He'll have to figure out which of the seven kitchen tables to sit at.
Well, it's a funny line, and he's a relatively adroit politician, but he doesn't talk about the credit card bills that are sitting on your kitchen table, brought to you by MBNA of Wilmington, Delaware.
Yeah. Well, John McCain. I don't think you think John McCain would be any better for the.
Good God! I hope you don't get the idea that I think McCain is any better on any of these things. He's much worse. But I'm just saying that if you think that the Democratic ticket is going to reform American society or going to bring back some equity or some really redress the tremendous imbalance that's taken place. It's occurred since Ronald Reagan was elected in class and economic stratification and extremes between rich and poor and so on and so forth. I think you're kidding yourself. These guys are conventional Democrats. Barack Obama comes from is sponsored by and trained by the Cook County Democratic machine, which is the most anti-democratic political organization in the country. Anti-democratic with a small D. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to believe that this is a reform candidacy or a candidacy, a ticket that is geared toward the working class, I think is, a gross exaggeration.
We're going to try to reestablish contact with our guest. We're getting a little bit of static on his phone line there, but he'll be back with us in a moment, and we will welcome your calls for him. John MacArthur is publisher of Harper's Magazine, and he is author of the book, You Can't Be President, The Outrageous Barriers to Democracy in America. We welcome your thoughts and questions for him at 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. He's talking presidential campaign politics with us this hour as the Democratic National Convention begins in Denver this week on the heels of Barack Obama selecting his running mate, Joe Biden, over the weekend. And John McCain expected to announce his VP pick on Friday. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you along. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up after 9 o'clock this morning, we bring you special coverage of the Democratic National Convention, an on-point special. You can join Tom Ashbrook for the latest news and analysis and guests from the Democratic National Convention in Denver, coming up after 9 o'clock this morning. Then after 10, Kathleen Dunn and her guest will recap some of the wildest rides to the White House, some of the funniest slogans, the convention fights, the campaign trail pranks, and more, as she talks with an editor from Mental Floss magazine after 10 o'clock this morning. We are also talking politics, presidential politics, during this hour with a guest from Harper's Magazine. He is the president and publisher of Harper's Magazine. He has written for a number of national newspapers and publications, and he is the author of the new book, You Can't Be President, The Outrageous Barriers to Democracy in America, talking with us about some of the latest political news, but also about the ideas he presents in his book. And John MacArthur, we all have heard that growing up and in school, that we can all be president if that's what we want to be. Why do you say differently?
Well, most people talk about money as a barrier these days, and it's true that money is a huge barrier. If you or I want to run for any kind of office in the United States, it takes a huge amount of money. Even running for city council is very expensive now. Hundreds of thousands of dollars in some cases in big cities, but you get up to the presidential level, you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. But the greater obstacle or barrier to entry into politics is the two-party duopoly. The Democratic Party and the Republican Party decide generally who's going to run for office and who will get to be president, so to speak. And the barriers to entry there are quite high. In other words, if you can't prove that you are a reliable member of the party, that you'll do what you're told, that you'll go along to get along, that you'll that you won't buck the system, that you won't take positions that are diametrically opposed or even somewhat opposed to the party leadership in your town or city or state, you don't get slated. And slating is the old-fashioned term. I grew up in Cook County that is used to describe when the Central Committee gets together and decide who gets to run for which office. Now, in the extreme cases like Chicago and Cook County, which is essentially, Chicago's a one-party city, if you're slated, you win. Now, in other states where there's a little bit more competition between Republican and Democrat, the slating process gives you a chance maybe to compete in the general election or the primary, but it certainly doesn't allow an amateur the possibility of just getting into politics because they feel like it. You got to jump through all sorts of hoops. And the example that I use in the book, in You Can't Be President, is the Ned Lamont example in Connecticut. There's a guy who was self-financed. He runs on a popular program, an anti-Iraq program, against Senator Joe Lieberman, the incumbent senator. This is in 2006, in the primary, because people are so angry with Lieberman for supporting Bush and the war. And to everyone's amazement, especially the party professionals in the state and in the country also, because Lieberman's a very important national Democratic Party politician, Lamont wins. I mean, this is a guy with hundreds of millions of dollars, so money's not his problem. He could self-finance his campaign. But once he gets the nomination, everybody runs from him, including Barack Obama. Barack Obama, who had endorsed Lieberman in the primary campaign, technically supports Lamont, but refuses to appear with him, won't do any campaign appearances with him, despite repeated efforts by the Lamont campaign to get him to do appearances. The Republican Party openly, really, supports Lieberman. They put up a stumble bum named Alan Schlesinger to run, a guy who got arrested for card counting and other cheating in an Indian casino in Connecticut. And they actively supported Lieberman against Lamont. So you had regular Democrats and the Republican Party coming together to defeat an insurgent, Lamont, who was too independent, too anti-war, not one of the club. In fact, Lamont told me in an interview that the state party chairman actually said to him, "Why don't you start, why don't you run for tax collector or whatever? Work your way up through the system."
Yeah.
So I'm saying that in, even if you're very rich, the party system, the way it's set up, makes it very, very difficult to compete and makes it almost impossible for an amateur to run.
Well, bringing it back to Barack Obama as someone that some people are calling an amateur, someone who's very new to the national scene anyway, a state legislator from Illinois, someone who's only been a senator for a handful of years, is now poised to become president of the United States. Isn't that amazing?
No, he's no amateur. I mean, he was schooled in the toughest, most rigorous school of political organizing in the country, which is Cook County. And this is a guy who knows how to find sponsors and get along with the powers that be. The man who was his sort of godfather in the Illinois State Senate, his name is escaping me right now, Emil Jones, I believe, he's the representative of Mayor Richard Daley in Springfield. He tutored Obama on how to be a politician. Being a state senator and being a U.S. senator, running those campaigns, getting the official support of the Daley machine, learning from Daley's closest advisors, two of them anyway, David Axelrod and another guy who's his chief fundraiser, Samuels, I've forgotten his first name. These are people who are in the system and know how the political system works. And Obama is a very, very precocious student. He's very smart. Tactically, you could say he's brilliant. He is no amateur.
Yeah.
He knows how to work the system. He knows how to raise money. And, the irony is it's all in his book. The Audacity of Hope is a kind of blueprint for fundraising.
Yeah.
He talks all about how he fundraises.
Yeah, so,
and from commercial banks, investment bankers, corporations, and so on.
Yeah. Well, what about John McCain, until recently, the maverick? I mean, throughout his Senate career, had been butting heads with some of his Republican Party leaders, has he not?
Yeah, and I think Obama still has a really good chance of winning precisely because the Republican Party is still split on McCain. McCain is not seen as reliable by his colleagues in the Republican Party. The Bush family hates him. He hates them. I mean, there's no love lost there. Even though he's a terrible hypocrite on lobbying reform and fundraising and so on, and did some corrupt things when he was chairman of the Commerce Committee and on behalf of various television networks and so on, and he had this relationship with this telecommunications lobbyist that you've read about. There is a corrupt and hypocritical side to McCain. Nevertheless, he does have enough independence, enough of a maverick streak, to have offended a lot of people in his party, and that's one reason he's hampered. If you look at the fundraising, you get a sense of where we are, where the country is. Barack Obama has outraised John McCain something like $850,000 to $330,000 among hedge fund partners. Now, hedge fund partners are at the white-hot center of what's wrong with the country, as far as I'm concerned. We can get into that more if you want. But the big money in hedge funds has gone to Obama, not to McCain, because I guess they don't think McCain is somebody, even though he mouths all the free market rhetoric that they want to hear, they don't trust him, whereas they trust Obama. They trust Obama to, again, not to rock the boat.
I thought that Obama was going to tax their profits like capital gains or do some sort of taxation.
Well, interestingly, he started out saying that about a year ago when Edwards was pressing him, because Edwards made it a campaign issue. Clinton and he both were forced to say, yeah, we'll treat the hedge fund income, partnership income, just like ordinary personal income. But he's dropped that. He stopped talking about it in the last several months. You haven't heard a word about it, and that bill is going nowhere in the Senate right now. In the meantime, he said, I will raise the capital gains tax from the current 15% to 25%. So the hedge funders who now are paying the capital gains tax on their income as opposed to the personal income tax, they would get a tax increase from 15 to 25%, but it would still be far less than the 39% they'd have to pay if Obama restores the top marginal rate to 39%. So I think this is a very clever, astute move by Obama so that he can have it both ways. He said, well, I did want to change it, but I can't get enough support in the Senate, but at least the hedge funders are paying a higher capital gains rate, 25%. Hedge funders are happy because they don't have to pay the 39%. I don't think that bill's going anywhere.
So, John MacArthur, what is, I guess, what's your point? I mean, are you saying we need to have a third party system, or what needs to happen in order for these outrageous barriers to be taken down?
Well, I think a third party would be great, or a fourth and a fifth and a sixth and a seventh mm-hmm. would be great. To unlock the stranglehold that the two parties have on the election machinery and the fundraising machinery, the cartel, I call it a cartel. But I have a chapter in my book about a rebellion in Portsmouth, Rhode Island, led by a woman named Connie Harding. And this is where I draw my inspiration and my hope, is from examples of local democracy in action. Connie Harding was a housewife, a bunch of kids. She and her husband had established themselves in a pretty good situation with a nice house. And one day she finds out that the Target Corporation is going to build a huge big box store right across the street from her. And she says, oh, my goodness, what am I going to do? And she hadn't really been involved in local politics. She said she hardly knew the names of any of the town council members. But she said, I got to do something. I got to protect my family. I got to protect my town, which is a very lovely town with no big boxes to speak of. And she organized all her neighbors. And next thing you know, they'd set something up called Preserve Portsmouth. And they took on Target Corporation. They took on the local real estate developer who wanted to lease the land to Target. Took on the town council, which was would likely have approved it without opposition, and they stopped the damn thing. You know, they just pulled themselves together and they stopped it. And so I say to people, instead of waiting around for the right president or the right political system to come along to save you, get active in local politics like Connie Harding. Do it from the ground up. You'll be amazed by what she can do, because she did an amazing thing. I mean, this is if you read the chapter, it's a remarkable story and object lesson in political local organizing, of citizen involvement. And this is a woman, she's got no time. She's got a job. Her husband's got to work full time. She's got a bunch of kids from two marriages. And she still is able to find the time and organize her fellow citizens in Portsmouth. And it's very empowering what happened there. So that's, yes, while we're waiting for a third or fourth or fifth party, I'd say follow the example of Connie Harding. What Connie Harding shouldn't do, or the Connie Hardings of Wisconsin or of Minnesota or of any other state shouldn't do, I think, is try to go into Democratic or Republican politics in the conventional way, because you just can't beat the system now. It's a racket.
Our guest is John MacArthur. He is the author of the new book, You Can't Be President, The Outrageous Barriers to Democracy in America. John MacArthur is also the president and publisher of Harper's Magazine. We welcome your questions for him, your reactions to what he has to say. Do you also do you agree with him that the two-party monopoly is a barrier to democracy in America? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Ed in West Allis joins us first. Hi, Ed, you're on the air.
Well, Ms. Cardine, I hope you're taking copious notes for David Newby next week, because everything that your guest is saying, it's so true to those of us in the working class. The last candidate who cared for us at all was John F. Kennedy. In that same election, we did have a true working class candidate by the name of Farrell Dobbs, who organized the Teamsters Union, basically, in Minnesota in 1932, from 32 to 36. And I think this year, I think a lot of us are just going to write in Gus Hall, because Gus Hall dead is better than these two guys alive. And that's just the reality for those of us who are in organized labor in 2008.
John MacArthur?
Well, what this gentleman is expressing, I think, is his frustration about the labor union movement in this country, without exactly saying it. The labor unions in this country for so long have done the bidding of the Democratic Party that they don't have any independence anymore. And there's not much left of American labor. You know, private sector labor union membership is now under 8%. You know, we're deindustrializing thanks to NAFTA and PNTR at a rapid, rapid rate. And candidates like Obama and so on are doing nothing about it. Now they just take labor for granted. Ralph Nader's always saying, well, if labor would just refuse to support one of these candidates, you might get something. But I think it's too late now. Labor has no clout left. There's really nothing left of labor they don't have any leverage, except in certain local races. Again, look at the fundraising. So-called big labor gave peanuts to Hillary Clinton and to Obama. They didn't really have a candidate. They tried a little bit with Edwards, but there just isn't enough money and enough membership there anymore to make a difference.
By the way,
I'm not saying you should write in Gus Hall. No,
Ed,
a dead man. I think there are other avenues you might want to proceed along before you just waste your vote.
Ed, thanks for the call. Ed referred to David Newby, the director of Wisconsin's AFL-CIO, who is a guest of ours on Labor Day. Every Labor Day for the past 20, 30 years or so has joined us to talk about organized labor and issues important to organized labor. And he is set to be with us on Labor Day during the 8 o'clock hour. So I guess I can ask him that. Ed, thanks for calling. George in Ogama. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Hi, John.
Hi.
And you have made my day, really. I agree with everything that you say. And I would like to say to these politicians that if they really can't make it, you know, don't fake it. Just be quiet. And I thank you very much for being on the program.
While we ask the politicians to be quiet, I'd like the citizens, it's supposed to be our country, of course, to make a lot more noise. We need to get a lot noisier.
Our guest, John MacArthur, the book, You Can't Be President, The Outrageous Barriers to Democracy in America. Our number, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890. You can also send your question or comment via email, talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Stay tuned at 9 o'clock for the On Point special coverage from the Democratic National Convention. Tom Ashbrook is on site and coverage live from Denver coming up after 9 o'clock. Followed by Kathleen Dunn and a guest also talking politics. We're talking politics with John MacArthur, author of You Can't Be President, The Outrageous Barriers to Democracy in America. Before we go back to the phones, John, what about Ralph Nader? I was at the farmer's market in Madison this weekend, and people were collecting signatures to put his name on the ballot. Not a tremendously difficult thing to do in Wisconsin to get your name on the ballot. Can't he be president?
No, he can't be president because the Electoral College system, of course, is stacked against anybody who tries to make it on the popular vote. I mean, he'd be lucky to get 5% in nationwide in the popular vote, but it doesn't count because the Electoral College system is an anti-popular vote mechanism. But a guy who says the sorts of things that Nader says, and he blurbed my book, is just not acceptable to the two-party system. I mean, he's talking about reforming the finance system for campaigns in a way that would take away all the leverage of the political parties. I mean, the great people think, and this is something I'm at pains to say in the book, people imagine that typically rich people bribe politicians, that they have a disproportionate amount of influence on politicians, and in some cases actually bribe or own politicians. Now, it is true that rich people and corporations have an easier time getting their calls returned and their views heard by Barack Obama than you or I. However, the typical relationship between a politician and a rich person is the reverse. The politician shakes down the rich person or shakes down the corporation and says, look, we got some legislation coming up that's of great interest to you. We might be interested in changing the tax code in a way to provide a loophole for the XYZ corporation. Hey, by the way, I'm selling tickets to my fundraiser next week. Are you in? And the lobbyist for XYZ corporation or the CEO of XYZ Corporation and his family feel obliged to buy tickets to the politicians' fundraisers. That's why you see, and it's in my book too, so many wealthy corporations and individuals contributing to both parties or all three candidates. In some cases, you've got some wealthy people giving to McCain, Obama, and Clinton. So this is what we're talking about here.
Tom in Verona is with us now. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Talking to me?
Yes, Tom. You're on the air.
I was wondering, is the possibility of an underclass populist movement eventually arising in the United States from the number of like Hispanics and other people who are coming into the United States?
Yeah, I think there's a possibility, but these people got to be legalized first. The horrible thing about the illegal immigration situation is these people have no rights. If they start organizing unions or try to get the right to anything, they're inviting deportation. the irony and the sad thing is that the populist underclass movement that you'd like to see, I think you'd like to see among immigrants and poor people and so on, or illegal immigrants and poor people, it's already happening, but it's happening on the right. The Minutemen and so on and so forth, the right-wing evangelicals, they're responding to the oligarchic, I guess I have to call it, control of the parties, of the finance system, and so on and so forth. The problem is they direct their anger at the immigrants, who they say are taking their jobs and stealing from the welfare system and so on. But there is a populist movement among the right-wing underclass or lower class. It's just not the right-wing movement. It's not the populist movement that a lot of liberals would like, that some liberals would like to see happen.
Bob Barr, former Republican, now running as a Libertarian for president, is calling for inclusion in the presidential debates. They're not going to be allowed in there, I guess, but the presidential debates that were announced for September 26th and October 7th. And I think there's going to be a town hall later on in the campaign. Talk some about Bob Barr's run as a Libertarian.
Well, he's an interesting guy. He's a convert. You know, he's started out being a Gingrich type and very pro-Bush and so on and so forth. And I guess as he would say he's a true conservative. In other words, he wants to adhere to constitutional principles, the sort of constitutional principles that would never have permitted the FISA compromise that Obama voted for. You know, that makes it a lot easier for the National Security Agency to listen to your phone calls, overseas phone calls, and so on and so forth. So he is what I would call, he and Ron Paul are the leading edge of this right-wing populist constitutional impulse in the country, which you could call genuinely conservative. Now, on social welfare, they're not great. You know, they don't believe in government intervention. They don't believe in helping the poor. It's a little bit like Pat Buchanan. Buchanan is also part of this movement. He's very anti-NAFTA, very anti-permanent normal trade relations with China, because he sees the damage it's done to the American economy and the American working class. But they're also anti-union. What you need is a political party that embraces not only some form of protectionism, but also is pro-union, because you need both.
Well, then there's the Green Party, too. We've had on this program Cynthia McKinney, the former congresswoman who's going to be running as a Green, apparently. What about that candidacy?
I don't know much about the Green Party. I know that Nader was their candidate, what was it, 4 years ago?
Yeah, now he's an independent.
And now he's independent, and Cynthia McKinney sounds more interesting than some of the other people I hear. I just don't think she has a chance. They'll never let McKinney or Nader or Barr or any of these people participate in the national debate. And the media, as it's so controlled, so centrally controlled, is not going to give these people enough time to be heard. You know, in France, every candidate for president is guaranteed free public airtime, no matter how small. You know, they have to get over some very minimal barrier to get on television, but they all get heard. So you hear 12 or 14 different points of view, ranging from far left to far right, during the presidential campaign. Here, we're just not going to get that.
Next, we go to...
And again, that's the two parties making sure that their cartel remains impregnable.
We'll talk more about that in a moment. First, Steele and Nina. Hi, Steele.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, it sounds like a terrible catch-22 because a few moments ago you said, yeah, it'd be nice to have third, fourth, fifth party, and how in a European country everyone can speak up. And so you were asked if Nader can make it. No, because of the cartel. Can the Green Party make it? No, because of the cartel. But is it true that if a Green Party or some other party got at least X percent in a state, that they would be legitimized and just start chipping away that way? Or Anyway, it sounds up for other opinions.
There is the possibility under the federal election law that Obama's not too interested in anymore, that if you get 5% of the national vote, is that right, you qualify for public financing?
There is a percentage there. I'm not positive it's
5%. I think it's 5%. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the argument, if you recall, in 2000 was vote for Nader, get him up to 5% so that at least he'll qualify for either for public financing or I think that's the rule. And that's why the two parties fought so hard to keep him, or the Democrats fought so hard to keep him off the ballot in so many states, because they didn't want him qualifying for any kind of public financing and thus give him a leg up in the national debate. So, yes, there is an argument for trying to get the Green Party or some other party up to that 5% level, I believe, in order to get them to qualify for public financing.
So what would it take to stop the cartel from allowing these third parties to, you know, have a chance?
Well, I think it's got to happen locally. Again, my example of Connie Harding, it's not an electoral example, but she's lobbying. She's pressuring her local city council to keep the Target out of Portsmouth, the Target store.
Yeah.
But it is conceivable that Connie Harding could form a local third party around a movement like Preserve Portsmouth. And don't forget, I mean, our greatest president, maybe Abraham Lincoln, was a party builder. He was one of the founders of the Republican Party. Thomas Jefferson was the founder, one of the founders of the Democratic Party. So two of our greatest parties two of our greatest presidents founded new political parties or helped found new political parties. It just takes an immense amount of work and today an immense amount of money. And I don't know where you get that money. You gotta find public-spirited people who are willing to do it, public-spirited people with some money. But again, I use the example of Ned Lamont. You can't do it on your own. Even with hundreds of millions of dollars, you need a lot of allies, a lot of friends.
Robin in Shorewood emails us, do you feel the media are complicit in perpetrating the Republican and Democratic monopoly? I watch CNN a few hours every day, and I haven't heard Bob Barr's name once in months. They just posted a new online channel called League of First-Time Voters, but they only list and discuss Obama and McCain.
Yeah, the media is complicit, and the media, the way it works in Washington, where a lot of the decisions are made in New York, but principally in Washington, about who's going to get covered and how much and so on and so forth, it's a patronage system. If you play ball, if you're a reporter or a producer or an editor and you play ball and you you give coverage to the leadership of the two parties, they reward you with tidbits, scoops, inside information, in some cases junkets. You might get on a local talk show or a national talk show, which in turn gets you big speaking fees at the XYZ Widget Convention in Kansas City. There's a whole system of patronage, reward, and punishment system. If you go outside the system and you suddenly... you're the assignment editor at NBC Nightly News, and you say, I want to get Nader on, or I want to get Cynthia McKinney on, I want to get these people on, you're punished by the two parties. They stop feeding you scoops. They stop feeding you information. And the next thing you know, your boss is at Viacom or at General Electric saying, hey, how come ABC and CBS have got the inside scoop on Joe Biden getting the nomination, and you didn't have it? Well, because you were being punished for going off the reservation. So you find yourself sent back to Cleveland or Milwaukee or Denver or whatever and writing about car accidents.
Yeah. Well,
you get kicked out of Versailles. I always say Washington is Versailles.
Or you just stay at Wisconsin Public Radio. We certainly invite all candidates on the ballot to talk with our listeners. In fact, we have better luck with Ralph Nader's and Bob Barr's and the third-party candidates than we do with the major party candidates, maybe because nobody else is talking to them or wants to talk to them.
Well, yeah, I mean, what you're doing is the media equivalent of what Connie Harding did in Portsmouth, and that's why I say more and more we got to focus on local issues, local control, local pressure, and build from the ground up. Because if you go from the top down, the cards are just too heavily stacked against you.
Joe in Darlington is with us. Hi, Joe.
Yeah. Good morning. This cartel you're talking about, wouldn't you say that, and the media is controlled by the cartel, wouldn't you say that the Council on Foreign Relations, or CFR, however you want to put it, are the ones that are in control? And wouldn't you also say that the John Birch Society thinks alike with Ron Paul and the gentleman that ran for president? You just talked about him. Wouldn't you say he's aligned with them? I mean, and that they're about as conservative on the same conservative line as Ron Paul? And
I'm not sure we're going to be able to answer all of that since we only have less than a couple of minutes.
I think that the Council on Foreign Relations is a symptom. They're not running things. I think they're just an adjunct to the Democratic Party and to the foreign policy establishment in the United States. The people with the real power in this country are still the elected politicians. Let me tell you, corporate CEOs, people you think are really running the country, they're afraid of politicians. They're afraid that they're going to get hurt by a change in the tax code more than they are just about anything else.
Yeah,
What do you say? I don't think the Council on Foreign Relations is exactly the problem. It's not a great organization, but
John, in our final minute, what do you say to those people who point to there is too a difference between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party? Just look at Al Gore versus George W. Bush.
Well, the problem there again is Al Gore looks a lot better now than he did during the 2000 campaign. Remember, Al Gore is the guy who beat Ross Perot in the debate on NAFTA. He had more to do with NAFTA getting passed, maybe, than anybody besides Bill Clinton. And if you think NAFTA is a good thing, okay, then you think Al Gore did a good thing. If you think it's a bad thing, Al Gore bears a lot of blame for NAFTA. He also was very much a part of the corrupt finance system. He's the guy making the calls, renting out the Lincoln bedroom at the White House for the Clintons. He did a lot of dirty work for the Clintons. Now he looks much better because he's been liberated from his day-to-day political duties. But he was very much in the system and didn't look so great in 2000 against Bush. Yes, there's a difference between the two parties, but they bury their differences when it suits their purposes.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
John MacArthur, author of You Can't Be President, The Outrageous Barriers to Democracy in America. Thanks to Rob Ferret, Carmen Jackson, and Cynthia Schuster for producing this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.